Good Friday afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for a Juno Afternoon today. Thanks so much for joining us today. We've got a full show, including a preview of this week's Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. And it's going to be about polar bears. And our guest is going to be Laurent Dick, who's going to be giving that talk. Rachel Wintz is here to be highlighting the Where's Girls on the Run. Also, Justin Showman and Andrea Campbell from right here at K2. We're going to get our appetites ready for next week's Seafood Festival. Troy Quinn will be here to talk about all the details of this weekend's concert by the Juno Symphony. And we're going to meet a couple of improv actors and find out about this weekend's shows happening at the Hangar in the Ballroom. We're going to get that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Prime Minister visited the remote northern Saskatchewan community of La Loche. That's where four people were killed a week ago after a teenager opened fire at a home and high school. Many of the residents are First Nations people. And as Dan Karpinchuk reports, many people in other communities are showing their support.
In the nearby community of Buffalo Narrows, a radio station held a charity auction for the families of the victims of the La Loche shootings. They consider themselves as family in the region, so just about everyone pitches in to help.
Like from kids' stuff to Valentine's to even knitted items. We do have these moose hide card holders.
We're all family. We all come together as one. You know, when they hurt, we hurt.
The auction got such a positive response that it was extended from one day to two and raised thousands of dollars. The Prime Minister also traveled to La Loche on Friday, where he spent the morning with families of the victims.
Looking forward to meeting the families and supporting a community that's obviously had a terrible, terrible week. We will stand with them today, tomorrow, for weeks and months to come.
Justin Trudeau has already pledged to help improve the quality of life for First Nations across the country, especially children.
We all need somebody.
There was other support, too, at this candlelight vigil in Regina this week held to honor the community of La Loche. The event was organized by teachers, but students, police, politicians, and others joined the crowd that walked to the Saskatchewan Legislative Building. Similar vigils were held in Saskatoon and Prince Albert. The first of the funerals for the victims is to be held on Saturday. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A campaign started by a newspaper publisher is underway to buy 40 acres of private land adjacent to the Wounded Knee Massacre site in South Dakota. The land is held by a non-native owner who's asking nearly $4 million for the property. Those backing the plan say it needs to be held by Lakota people and used in a positive way. Charles Michael Ray reports.
Newspaper publisher Tim Gallego says he wants to see a museum and arts and trade center built on the property once it's acquired.
I've talked with several elders and with some of the descendants of the survivors of Wounded Knee, and I think all of them have one thing in common. They say the 125th anniversary of Wounded Knee just passed. So we spent 125 years remembering and honoring the people that died there in that horrible massacre. And we respect them and will continue to honor them, but we feel now that it's time for us to start honoring the living.
Gallego says currently Native artists on Pine Ridge have few places to create and sell their work. He says the museum could play a similar role to Jewish Holocaust museums as a way to show incidents of genocide against Indigenous nations. He says these are histories that shouldn't be ignored.
People could come and everything that they have not been taught in the schools, and that's a lot, could then learn about the history of so many tribes.
But some Pine Ridge residents have expressed concern, saying they want to see the land turned over to the Lakota people, but they don't want to see it developed. Gallego says any development would require consent of the people. His nonprofit fund has been established, and he hopes to see the money raised for both the purchase of the land and the creation of a museum and art space. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
New Zealand actor and director Taika Waititi is hosting the Feature Film Award Ceremony at the Sundance Film Festival on Saturday. His feature film, Hunt for the Wilder People, was among six films by Indigenous filmmakers screened at Sundance this year. A number of Native Americans representing tribes across the country are participating in the festival in Park City, Utah. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support by Indigenous Governance Programs at the University of Arizona, educating practitioners and policymakers to implement nation-building at home and create stronger Native nations. Course offerings at igp.arizona.edu. Support by the Heard Museum, hosting the 26th annual Hoop Dance World Championship, where you can see more than 70 talented Native hoop dancers vie for the championship title, February 13th and 14th. Details at heard.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Perseverance Theater presents a world premiere by Tlingit playwright Vera Starbard. Our voices will be heard. Come witness this new story of a mother's fierce love for her young daughter and the lengths she will go to protect her. This powerful play raises the question, will we stay silent when met with family violence, or will we be resilient and speak out to end the cycle? Our Voices Will Be Heard opens on January 15th. For more information and tickets, visit ptalaska.org, the Jack and Hearthside Books.
And welcome back to a Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you today. And I have with me Laurent Dick, who is a guide that takes people up to, far north to go check out polar bears. So you've spent a lot of time in the past number of years face-to-face and looking at polar bears and that kind of thing, and you're going to be talking about it at the Friday Fireside Lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. And what time is that? That's happening tonight, right?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andy. It's tonight at 6:30 and at 8 o'clock.
Okay. So you'll do two different lectures, I'm guessing that it's a lot of photographic things you're looking at and showing different behaviors and those sort of things?
Yeah, it's primarily a visual journey. You know, I'm a photographer foremost and not a scientist, so I will definitely try to inspire the audience through my images and take them along on a journey to one of the best places to see polar bears, actually in the world, not just in North America. You know, there's a couple other places where you can see polar bears. Predictably, one is in Churchill, Manitoba, one is in Svalbard in Norway, but what we have here in our backyard is really incredible.
So tell me what it is that fascinates you specifically about polar bears. I mean, they're an animal that I think so many people are fascinated with, but what is it that do you feel some sort of a connection in a way to why you're drawn to see them?
I think what fascinates me the most is the intersection between culture and the polar bears. And in Kaktobik, you have a really unique situation where you have a community and polar bears that are coexisting for several months in really close proximity. And that's just something that's really fascinated me. When I first came to North America, I was really interested in people's adaptation to extreme landscapes. And I spent a lot of time in the Arctic. I spent a full winter up in the high Arctic in Canada. And I've always been interested in people's adaptations. And now, of course, you add polar bears into the picture, which makes it for something really unique and dynamic.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about what you've learned about polar bears in your time. First of all, tell me how long you take me a little bit on the kind of personal journey of first seeing polar bears when that happened to now when it's you're seeing them maybe more often than most people ever would see, will. Yeah.
Sure. You know, I had my first encounter with polar bears in about 12 years ago. I was on assignment heading out to a little diamond island in a Bering Strait. And as we were flying over the Chukchi Sea, we could see these little white dots on fragmented sea ice. And this was when I get my first glimpse of polar bears, and it was very cool.
Yeah.
And during a ski meet, there were kids skiing across the dateline into tomorrow, into Russia, and then back. And there were residents carrying firearms. They were the local polar bear patrol, and it just blew me away. It's something that you know, you will not experience anywhere else in this world.
And now, as you say, you kind of guide people. You take people up to Kaktovik is where you go to.
Yes.
Barter Island is the name of the island. Tell me a little bit about what that experience is like
okay.
when you see that island. And
Well, I do want to mention, you know, the polar bear viewing is really a very recent phenomena, and it is happening because polar bears are losing their habitat. You know, polar bears are marine mammals. They are not terrestrial mammals. And for many, many years, thousands of years, we would hardly ever see them on the coast of Alaska. Now that the sea ice is receding, we're seeing more and more polar bears that are coming on land to rest and to feed, and also an increasing number of females, pregnant females, that are opting to have their cubs on land. If you look at the distribution of denning sites along the North Slope, it is really phenomenal. It's almost now the bulk of denning sites is actually on land and not out on the sea ice anymore.
So it's a complete change from the thousands of years of their behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're witnessing a really, really rapid change up in the Arctic. And again, you know, for the polar bears, the sea ice is their existential platform. Without the sea ice, they will not survive. In the case of the population that we're observing, it's the southern Beaufort Sea population. It's sort of that narrow strip reaching out off the coast, the first 200 miles that is the most productive. That's where the seals are. It's a very shallow area along the continental shelf. Now, the sea ice there is receding more and more. It's forming later. It's leaving sooner, and it's thinner, and it's making it harder and harder for the polar bears to survive there. That population is one of the most studied populations in the world, and they've noted quite a decline. Say between 2000 and 2010, the population went down from 1,500 down to 900. Now it's sort of stabilized, but you know, it's you don't have to be a rocket scientist. If you look at the sea ice distribution and how things are melting, the future of polar bears in Alaska and in the circumpolar north is not very good.
Is it when you talk about this, I would think, you know, I have a ambition to see a polar bear someday. I would love to see a polar bear. I never have. But is it a sad experience now, given what's happening with the environment?
That's a good question. I think it's both. On one hand, I just admire this animal that has made a home in the Arctic and that has all these absolutely unique adaptations to survive in one of the most extreme environments on this planet. But on the other hand, yes, in the back of my mind, I always realize that the reason I'm seeing them here is because they're losing their habitat. So it's kind of a bit conflicting experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about just some things you've learned about polar bears in the years of observing them, things that maybe people wouldn't know or wouldn't suspect or maybe have misperceptions about.
I think, you know, especially being up on Barter Island, what's interesting is that the polar bears are nocturnal. So they are staying outside of town.
No, I never knew
They're
that.
They're staying outside of town during the day, and then at night they start moving. And that's when, of course, the polar bear patrol is making its rounds around town because the polar bears are hungry. And the reasons they're there is because the local Inupiat are allowed to harvest bowhead whales in the fall at a quarter of three. And after they harvest the whales, they put the bones and the scraps on the bone pile near town, and that's what, of course, what attracts the bears. But there's a lot of meat also lying around town, muktuk and meat, and that's what's, of course, attracting those bears coming into town. So I remember one night, actually it was early in the morning, I was walking back from a cabin I was staying with back to the hotel, and it had snowed, and it was just, there was not a single track, and I was walking through the village, and then a couple hours later, I was walking back to the cabin, and there were huge polar bear tracks in my own tracks, and that's where I realized, you know, it's the real thing, you know,
yeah.
These polar bears are coming into town.
And I mean, they are truly hunting. Or are they just looking for scraps?
They are hunting for scraps. I mean, some of these bears, they are stressed. They are nutritionally stressed. They haven't eaten for a month. And that's, I think, one of the unique adaptations of polar bears. They don't hibernate, but they can go without food for a prolonged period of time, which is quite really incredible, but they're hungry. There's no doubt about it. And whether it's the big boars or the sows with the cubs, and unfortunately, you know, there are conflicts that happen. They have gone into people's houses, kind of like in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, bear, whether it's a polar bear or a black bear or grizzly bear that's habituated to food, is a dead bear.
Yeah.
You know, you can't relocate these bears.
Once they kind of realize that that's something that they can eat and it's there, that's it.
Yeah.
They've learned that, they've adapted to that. Well, this is fascinating. We could talk about this for on and on, but if folks listening want to hear more about this and want to see some of the beautiful photography of the polar bears as well, please go tonight, 6:30 and 8 o'clock is when the talk is happening. It's going to get it's the fireside lecture, for the Friday fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and it's going to be all about polar bears with the guests that we've been talking to, Laurent Dick. Laurent, thanks so much. It's great to meet you, and fascinating to talk to you about the polar bears.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Back to a Juneau afternoon where, that was Band on the Run, but we're going to have Girls on the Run soon and also a Boys Run, and we're going to talk to Rachel Wintz and also Cecilia Westman's here to talk about that, Aware's Girls on the Run and the Boys Run program. So thanks to both of you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rachel, I'll start with you, the Girls on the Run. Tell me a little bit about the time, the place, and sort of the idea behind the race.
Yeah, we're about to start off our spring season for Girls on the Run, and we've got a big season coming up here. So Girls on the Run basically is an empowerment program for the girls in 3rd through 8th grade, and we use running games to teach girls life lessons that empower them, build their self-confidence and self-esteem. And our spring season is starting here in mid-February, about a week and a half it'll start up, and it goes all the way till mid-May, and we end the season with a celebratory 5K that's lots of fun and kind of celebrates all the work that the girls have put in throughout the season.
Very cool. And then the Boys Run, tell me that part of it. I haven't heard about that one before. Is this new?
Yeah, it's relatively new.
Okay.
So it's called Boys Run Ituwu Klatsin.
Okay.
And that part means strengthen your spirit. In this program, it is also a social-emotional empowerment program, similar to Girls on the Run, but there are Southeast Alaska Native components within the curriculum itself.
Cool. And so that's sort of tying that culture to kind of lessons about how to live healthfully and those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And through the program, we advocate for male mentorship. And so we seek male mentors to be coaches for the boys to walk them through these lessons and to also teach them how to build their endurance so they can run a 5K as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, mm-hmm. That's also part of it, right, running the 5K. That's a fun goal to have at the end of this. It seems like that can allow for a fun thing to be a goal that really shows progress.
Definitely,
yeah.
We teach goal setting through the program and lets the kids know that when they set a goal and work toward it, then they can achieve anything and they can apply these skills kind of throughout their whole lives.
How long have you been doing the Girls on the Run program?
I've been here for a year, but okay. We started the Girls on the Run program in 2008 in Juneau, and the program has grown steadily since. I actually was in Barrow last weekend, chilling with the polar bears.
Oh, yeah.
Just like La Raza.
Right.
Yeah, and trained them on how to do Girls on the Run up there. So that's our northernmost site for Girls on the Run.
Oh, so is it something that, how did the program itself start? Is it something that started here in Juneau, or is it something that's a national thing? Or
it's international now.
Okay.
So the program started in 1996 in North Carolina and has grown steadily since. So it's all across the U.S. and in Canada. And there are 225 different councils across the U.S. and Canada. So it's big.
Very
and
cool.
And it's exciting. And we actually have some new things coming up this season. So we have a program for our middle schoolers that is brand new. And it's a 10-week program that teaches life skills to girls, again, using running and conditioning exercises, and kind of teaches them, like, team building. It teaches them boundary setting, how to set goals, how to solve problems, how to take care of themselves. And the central concept of this program is the girl wheel. So it takes into account the body, brain, heart, spirit, and social, kind of the whole girl as we're doing this curriculum.
Well, that's a really fun way of thinking about it, that you can't be a sort of healthy entire person without paying attention to a lot of different aspects of who you are as a person. You know, you can't, just because you're a great athlete doesn't mean you're necessarily living in the healthiest way if you're not paying attention to other things, right? I guess that's sort of the concept.
Exactly. Yeah. And I like what you said about being a great athlete. So that's something that's not a requirement of these programs. I think a lot of times when we say we need coaches for Girls on the Run, they think, oh, you know, I have to be an athlete or a runner. But really, you don't. We're just looking for people who are positive role models for kids in the third through eighth grade who really want to encourage them throughout their journey and help them develop into the person that they are today.
Great. So that's happening for both the girls program and also the boys program.
Yes.
So if someone's out there listening right now and wants to get involved in that, how can they do it?
They're welcome to contact us directly at AWARE. You can call 586-4902. That will reach our AWARE prevention program. Or you can reach out to us via email. I could be reached at Cecilia, that's CECELIAW, at awareak.org. And Rachel?
And I'm at rachelw@awareak.org. So one of the things that's kind of required of a coach is, first of all, just to be a great role model and mentor to kids. And we meet 1 to 2 times per week for 10 to 12 weeks and for about an hour and a half after school.
I was going to just about to ask that. Like, okay, if someone does sign up, are there varying levels of time commitment that someone could do, or is there sort of a baseline? It sounds like that's the baseline you want people to be able to attend.
Yeah, our
these
main
meetings.
Need is for coaches right now.
Right.
We've got a big season coming up. All of the elementary schools and middle schools, except for one, are participating this season. So we'll need lots of volunteer coaches. And again, it's just 1 to 2 times a week after school for an hour and a half.
Great. And what's the deadline on, becoming a coach?
Yeah. So we'll have a full day coach training for our new coaches, and those are on February 6th, so next Saturday, and February 20th.
Oh, great. So there's actually plenty of time. Even if you can't make the one on the 6th, you can make the one on the 20th.
Yeah.
And,
so
okay.
On the 6th is for our elementary school coaches, and on the 20th is for our middle school coaches.
I see. Okay. Well, it's Girls on the Run and also Boys Run. And thanks so much to Cecilia and Rachel for coming in, letting us know about it. If you want more information on it, contact AWARE, and they'd be more than happy to get you helping coaching. Or maybe people who want to, kids want to participate. If you have kids or you're involved with kids that want to participate as well, contact AWARE.
Yep.
Thanks so much. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, coming up next here is Writer's Almanac.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 29th of January, 2016. It's the birthday of Anton Chekhov, born 1860 in the little seaside town of Taganrog. His father was a grocer. Chekhov went off to Moscow to study and become a doctor. Chekhov said, "Our talents we got from our father, but our soul from our mother." He finished medical school in Moscow, 1892, but he was writing for magazines and newspapers to supplement his income because he needed to support his family. His articles became very popular, published his first major work, 1888, a novella called The Steppe. He was also working on a play which he called Wood Demon, about a long-winded, bitter man. He worked hard on it. The play eventually became Uncle Vanya, was produced in 1899, and in the midst of completing that play, he wrote another, The Seagull, which made his name in Russia, and then The Three Sisters. Chekhov put forward a theory which he called Chekhov's gun. Remove everything that has no relevance to the story. If you say in the first chapter that there is a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter it absolutely must go off. If it is not going to be fired, it should not be hanging there. It's the birthday of the novelist Edward Abbey, born Indiana, Pennsylvania, 1927, moved off to the Southwest, worked as a fire lookout and ranger out there, best known for his novel The Monkey Wrench Gang, about four characters who will do anything it takes to stop developers from coming in and destroying the West. And it's the birthday of the man who said, if I had to live life over, I'd live over a saloon. W.C. Fields, born William Dukenfield in Derby, Pennsylvania, 1880, who wrote screenplays, The Bank Dick, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, and You Can't Cheat an Honest Man. Here's a poem for today by Sharon Bryan, entitled Foreseeing. Middle age refers more to landscape than to time. It's as if you'd reached the top of a hill and could see all the way to the end of your life, so you know without a doubt that it has an end, not that it will have, but that it does have, if only in outline. So for the first time you can see your life whole, beginning and end, not far from where you stand, the horizon in the distance. The view makes you weep, but it also has the beauty of symmetry, like the earth seen from space. You can't help but admire it from afar, especially now, while it's simple to re-enter whenever you choose, lying down in your life, waking up to it just as you always have, except that the details resonate by virtue of being contained as your own words coming back to you define the landscape, remind you that it won't go on like this forever. A poem by Sharon Bryan, Foreseeing, from her collection Flying Blind, published by Saraband Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business, with in-store print shops offering customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. In-store and online, Staples make more happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Don't you laugh, Justin Showman. Andrew Campbell also here. We're talking Seafood Fest. Always fun when these guys come in because they're just right around the corner and the next office over. But K2 having the Seafood Fest once again, and it sounds like it's really amping up.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, right?
Yes, it is.
They're like, yes, that's great. There's no more
so
extra work
to
at
do
all. Yeah.
So little time.
So you're doing it in Centennial. We're doing it in Centennial Hall this year. Over at Alaskan Brewing, there's the Tudor Beer Tasting. We're excited about doing that over at the brewery. Then, of course, you've got all these great partners coming in, these restaurants that are going to do different things with the seafood that Taku Smokeries has donated. Boy, it's just everyone's involved in this thing.
They really are.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing between the restaurants coming in and the brewery and the silent auction and everything.
Live music.
Centennial Hall, live music. We have so many people
it's
involved.
It is
a festival. Yes, it is,
it
Andy
truly
Klein.
Is.
Finally living up to its name, this thing.
It is very much that.
It is totally a festival. So let's start with, Justin, let's start with the restaurants. Who's involved? How's that going to work?
We have 8 participating restaurants this year. Typically, we've had 6, but with the growth of this event, we have expanded that a bit, and Andrea actually has the full list. I want to make sure I don't miss anyone.
Okay.
All right, so we've got Abby's Kitchen, Breeze Inn, The Rookery, Saffron, Salt, Sawana Thai Cafe, TK McGuire's, and V Cellar Door. So a lot of people who have participated with us in the past, and then actually quite a few new ones as well, which we're really excited
really
to
cool.
bring on.
Yeah, and ones that you don't necessarily think about all the time of like, oh, yeah, well, of course they have a great staff. Like, I eat at the Breeze Inn all the time out of Lemon Creek. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, that's going to be really cool. They're going to have those same chefs that do all the cool stuff that they already do. Doing the seafood, which is going to be awesome, yeah.
We've actually got a couple menu submissions already. Breeze Inn is first on the list. They're going to be doing some rockfish sliders.
Cool.
Yeah. Halibut stuffed jalapenos wrapped in bacon from TK McGuire's. It sounds like the Rookery is going to be doing some sausage with their salmon. Talked to Luke today, still not entirely sure what's going to happen with the halibut, but I'm sure he'll get back to me soon.
All right.
hint, hint, Luke.
Work in progress there. Yeah, okay. Thinking about
yeah.
Can't stifle that creativity, man.
Right.
Let it happen, yeah.
what else have we got? Korean Mexican infused rockfish tacos from V's Cellar Door, Thai spaghetti salmon and green curry sauce from Suwana. The menu is looking great. Halibut scampi with kimchi rice by V's. We have a rockfish tom yum, and we also have a seafood stuffed rockfish from TK McGuire's.
So wow.
Yeah.
That sounds incredible.
And that's
so far.
Just dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have dessert to get to as well. Copa's going to be there. We have Heritage providing cookies and coffee service. And we have recently, as of yesterday, added Eric Scholl's Glacial Grinds. Doing shaved ice.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to be fabulous.
Oh, very
I mean, there's
nice.
Just so much going on.
Yeah, dessert. You get the whole different, all these different treatments of the fish. It's just so fun to try the different stuff and all the different treatments. And then tell me about the live music.
Well, we have the Rob Cohen Jazz Trio.
They're great.
They are. And
love
the
them.
Great Alaskan Bluegrass Band.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, come now.
Oh,
come
just
on.
Kidding.
Right.
That's right next door.
Just in the next room
honestly.
Is why I said that. Just trying to get a rise out of them. No, they're awesome. It's going to be really fun. And fun background music to have the jazz and the bluegrass, but also like, hey, have fun, dance a little bit.
We have a dance floor set up.
Right.
I mean, this is going to be the party to be at.
How many of the ballrooms of the Centennial are you doing?
All 3.
You're doing the full thing.
We're doing
the
full thing, plus lobby space. we're
going
to have a photo booth with nautical-themed props and such.
Very nice.
It's going to be fantastic.
It's going to be the talk of the town. We also have, along with the Tudor Beer Tasting from 5 to 6, Louis Douglas Inn is kindly providing service for a no-host bar for the rest of the evening. So we will have beer and wine available throughout the night. It's really going to be a good time. And out in the lobby, along with our desserts and one of the bars, we'll have a silent auction as well. So we're still collecting items.
It's a lot of moving parts, you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of it.
It's
one
been
week
quite
left.
The month, I'll tell you.
Well, it's a really fun idea to take this thing that has been this tradition here at K2 and that people really love, and it really kind of had this homespun thing. We, all the volunteers, we used to slave over this halibut, and we'd go out and grill. Ben Brown was the guy who was always out grilling in the parking lot, and it's really fun to see it kind of go from those days to this really great thing where we have professional chefs doing amazing things with this donated fish that Taku Smokers, you can't say enough about. the amount of fish that they're donating and just what a great contribution that is. And then, the beer tasting's always been a part of it, so that's really a fun tradition to keep going. Live music, we kind of tried, like, we got live music at some point. I can't remember, it was like 8 years ago or something.
Oh,
and that
wow.
was a good element. And it's fun to see all those things get added along and turn it into a true festival.
Yeah, Justin and I witnessed it for the first time last year, and we kind of thought on it a little bit and thought there were a couple things we could add in and maybe change the venue. And
yep.
So here we are, ready to go.
Ready to go.
One week away.
But we should say tickets are selling really fast. We only have about 100 tickets left out of 300. So if you haven't gotten your ticket yet, now is the time to do it.
Well, that's a good warning. Yeah, wow, already two-thirds sold out. Yeah. So,
This event has sold out for a long time, and we're definitely looking to be on that path again this year. So if you want to go, I would definitely recommend going to ktoo.org or coming into the station before the event, because there is no guarantee with this one that we're going to have any left at the door.
Very cool. All right, so the Festival of Seafood, KTOO, it's all happening at Centennial Hall on February 6th, that's Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And when's it start? Five to six is the tutored beer tasting, right?
Right.
Okay, and then the dinner starts 6 on, kind of. That's when the food starts getting served out, yeah.
Yep.
And live music and fun and everything and dancing and the whole nine
just
yards.
Festing.
And silent auction and all kinds of stuff going on.
Yep.
Desserts.
It's going to be a great
everything.
Time.
Yeah.
Craziness.
Packed
into
3 hours.
All right. Thanks so much. Go to kto.org to get tickets for that coming up right now. Here is Bird Note.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Imagine this Canada goose paddling along on a cold winter day. Can you guess how many feathers cover this goose? Hundreds? Thousands? A single Canada goose has between 20 and 25,000 feathers. A smaller bird, like a sparrow or wren, might have 7 to 10,000. Those feathers are uniquely designed to help the bird fly, shed water, or display distinctive markings. A great many feathers are the short, fluffy kind, the down, whose purpose is to insulate the bird from the cold. Birds survive in sub-zero weather by fluffing their feathers, creating layers of air and feathers. Just a fraction of an inch of this insulation can keep a bird's body temperature at 104 degrees, even in freezing weather. People learned years ago how well goose down insulates, and began stuffing comforters, sleeping bags, and clothing with it. More recently, we've developed artificial substitutes, but geese and other birds continue to get along just fine with the original material. January is a good time to begin a new volunteer activity, and Audubon chapters can help you find your niche. After all, niche in French means to nest. To learn about opportunities, begin with a visit to birdnote.org.
Join the Juno Symphony for an exciting ride at Thunder Mountain High School on Saturday, January 30th and Sunday, January 31st. The concert will open with Mozart's beloved overture from the Magic Flute. Then our youth competition winner, Trevor Fiskus, will join us on piano for Shostakovich's Behemoth Second Piano Concerto. We will conclude with Brahms' Rapturous Fourth Symphony. Tickets at Hearthside, The Jack, or JunoSymphony.org. Come experience the Juno Symphony. Adventure awaits.
And we've got those adventurers right here in the studio with us right now, Trevor Fiskus, the youth solo competition winner. Trevor, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
And Troy Quinn, right here, the musical director at the Juno Symphony. Thanks so much for coming
Great
as well.
Great to be here, Andy.
This sounds like a lot of fun. You're taking on Shostakovich.
Yeah.
You're doing it.
I'm doing it.
It must be challenging, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So what's the most challenging thing about taking on, when we call it a behemoth, right?
Yes.
I mean,
it's a monster piece, and Trevor's playing it so beautifully. Not only is it challenging for the orchestra, Andy, but also the pianist. And it's just a monumental work, just the sheer playing and technical virtuosity that Trevor has to display and that the orchestra has to display.
Right.
Full of colors and technically demanding, and it's just going to be a real thrilling ride.
Yeah, what is when you're playing that, what is it you're concentrating the most on, the expression of it or the technical doing of it, or is it just
Probably listening to the symphony and staying with the symphony because it's a new thing to play with an orchestra. And I already have the piece memorized, so...
But that's interesting, but you have the piece memorized in your own pacing and in your own way and as a solo artist. And, yeah, that's a really fascinating part of it. I mean, that must be... That's hard.
Yeah.
That sounds hard.
Yeah. It's very cool, though.
So how do you help a solo player like that who comes from that world adjust to playing with a symphony?
Yeah, great question, Andy. Well, you know, I try to describe it a little bit as... almost a traffic cop sort of situation where you're just holding everybody together. And, of course, we're making great music and wonderful artistry with Trevor's beautifully sensitive playing, and our orchestra is really just rising to the challenge. But for my role is to try to hold it all together because, you know, as a pianist, Trevor's used to playing solo. And, you know, the orchestra used to going at its own pace. So there is an inherent challenge about working with both those groups and as an ensemble staying together, which is part of the fun of it.
And I mean, I guess it's your, I was about to say, well, who gives, but I guess it's up to you to direct who gives, sort of, right? I mean,
yeah.
You're trying to keep
a little bit, you know, we're kind of following what the soloist wants to do,
okay.
And I try to enforce that as best I can, but, you know, the orchestra is just so musically sensitive and just, you know, we have wonderful players here in Juno that are able to adjust and follow, and so, you know, that's the excitement, too, of live music and doing a piece like Shostakovich. It's thrilling, and at any moment, you never know what could happen because you really have to have sheer focus to deliver the piece. So.
What is it about that piece that really excites you about playing it?
Well, there's a lot of different parts to it, but I really like upbeat pieces and more challenging pieces, and... my teacher brought me a few different options, and I was listening to them, and that was the one I decided on. It just really resonated with me and works.
So this is the piece that you've kind of been living with for a while during the competition and really learning every single facet of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So then how long does it take for the symphony to get prepared to play that piece?
We rehearse in about a two-week cycle.
Really? Just 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's
wow.
Pretty quick,
yeah.
Actually. Quick turnaround. And we had rehearsal last night, and also we had a Music in the Schools concert tonight.
And
so
you're still speaking with each other?
We're on good.
Everything's
great
good
terms.
So far?
Absolutely.
We had a little run-through today with our Music in the Schools concert. It went very well.
Very
and
cool.
I should mention, too, you know, the piece, Shostakovich wrote it for his son for his 19th birthday. Trevor's 17. It's a pretty apropos.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Yeah, that's really cool. Well, so tell me a little bit, just the nuts and bolts of when's it happening and how people can go see it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we're at Thunder Mountain High School this time in the auditorium tomorrow at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. Tickets are available at the Jack, Hearthside, and JunoSymphony.org. We definitely advise you, if you can come, to come Sunday because Saturday is most likely going to be sold out. We're in a smaller, a little bit of a venue, but a beautiful, beautiful auditorium, and you know, we're hoping to sell at both performances. It's
cool.
Going to be thrilling. And
it's
the
always,
other piece,
always
on
fun
the,
to go to a sold out symphony performance. Too.
It is.
I mean, it's really,
yeah, it's great
exciting.
To perform.
Yeah.
And we're also performing Brahms' Fourth Symphony, which has never been done before by the symphony. By Juno, so that'll be a premiere for Juno,
oh,
which will be
great.
Exciting. Yeah.
How do you go about picking those kinds of selections?
Very carefully.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time with it and make sure there are pieces that I can tolerate listening to for 2 months in advance. You know?
Right, that's the real thing.
It's a big preparation, and
yeah.
Also what will challenge our orchestra and what our audiences will like. And you know, this is music for everybody. It's an emotional journey, whether you've listened to classical music or not. You're going to get something out of it.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. Troy Quinn, the musical director at the Juno Symphony, and Trevor Fiskus, congratulations, first
Thank you.
And foremost, the youth solo competition winner. And how long did that process go? Was that just a kind of a one-time thing, or is that just a one-time performance, or how did that...
The competition?
Yeah.
So it was in June of last year.
Okay.
And I started preparing for it in October of 2014. And, it was the one-time performance, and there was three judges, and we went there, and my teacher, Mary Watson, she accompanied me to act as the symphony during that. And so,
when you
yeah.
did it, did you feel like, I nailed it? Or did you feel like, oh, I hope they didn't, how did it feel to you when you did it?
I felt good about
good.
It. It was,
yeah,
it was
cool.
One of my better
That's why he
performances
won.
Of it. Yeah.
That's good.
But it was all up in the air until they announced my name, so
right.
I really didn't know whether to feel good or not until at the end.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm feeling good now, and the culmination of it, really, this is such an exciting, must be an exciting
yeah.
thing to have happen, to play a full symphony and have that work really pay off by getting people to see it. It's quite an achievement.
Yeah.
We're looking
very
forward
amazing.
To it. Yeah.
So thanks, Trevor, and thanks so much, Troy. And that's the Juno Symphony playing this weekend, 8 p.m. Tomorrow. And then what time again, Sunday?
3 p.m.
3 p.m. on Sunday. Thanks so much, you guys. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Andy.
Right.
Yep, thank you.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in, open skating, hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, youth, adult, hockey, and figure skating programs. More information at juno.org/parksrec/icerink or call 586-0410.
Hey, welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host on this Friday as we're heading into the weekend. So fun, all this great stuff happening on the weekend, including an improv fest, an improv fun show.
Yeah, that sounds about
deal
right.
Going
yeah.
on. Sarah Shoemaker's with me, Michael Ichow, and also Michael Christensen. So thanks you guys for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Well,
and
thanks for having us.
Yeah,
so
thanks.
Tell me about all I have right here. I have it on the sheet. There's an improv thing this weekend. So let me know what's going on.
You're very correct.
That's true.
There is Hangar Ballroom, right?
Yeah. Hangar Ballroom at 8 o'clock today and tomorrow.
Okay.
Sarah and I, we are the improv group Tal Grande Venti. We've traveled around the country performing improv. We're really delighted to be in Juneau performing for the next two nights. And also, the show tonight will feature Cogs and Goggles, the steampunk improvised show. And Mike Christensen actually would be able to say a little bit more about that.
You're looking a little steampunky right now.
I am.
My friend there, Michael. How are you doing?
Getting into character.
Yes, I like the chops going. That's good stuff there, yeah. So so that's the theme of this performance that's happening tonight? Or
One of the
okay.
two. So we as a duo, our show is currently set in a coffee shop, and then we have scenes throughout, usually telling a full story.
Oh, and that's an interesting approach. So it's not just setting up, and we're going to set up skits, but you have this kind of parameter for a scene, and then you improv within that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like we always start off in a coffee shop, and it's just a full story. So however the story progresses, and we just tell that.
Yeah, still taking a word of inspiration from the audience, and then just kind of making it up from there.
Is it, would you say it's typically humor-based, or is it, can it go in other directions as well?
Yeah, it's typically fairly comedic with some surprise moment of feels, so that's our goal.
I feel like whimsy is the more accurate word for what we do than anything else.
That's a pretty good word for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and Michael, tell us about the steampunk component here that's happening.
It's the premiere of Cogs and Goggles, which is set in 1895, at a time when the Industrial Revolution and the Computer Revolution occurred simultaneously. And it's the ongoing adventures of the airship Victoria.
So how does that – so that's a very developed – theme. How does that lend itself to then improv?
We have the characters. We've worked on developing the backstory of the characters. So we take the story that we're going to that the audience picks out and play it as those characters
would. How do you get the audience to do it? Do you have suggestions, or do you just build it on arbitrary phrases, or how do you...
We have 100 chapters set out, and they pick a number between 1 and 100.
Oh, okay.
And we go from there. Also playing tonight is Seriously Obnoxious.
Okay, great.
Which is three dirty old women who are the opposite of whimsy. So you get the entire spectrum of improv tonight. You have Seriously Obnoxious, TGV, and a steam punk improv.
Very cool. Well, what's your background? Where do you hail from?
So the two of us currently live in different cities. Sarah lives in San Francisco. I'm in Seattle. And we went to grad school together for acting in California. That's how we met. And we've been just kind of traveling the country, doing different festivals and performing at different theaters, teaching workshops.
So how did you go from meeting in school and then it started? You start getting like paying gigs. Like how do you?
Oh, that's a really great question. So it was basically like this was something that we really liked doing, and I don't think either of us ever expected to be paid. And so it's just like continually popping up at different festivals and applying and trying to make really good improv, a really good product to share with everyone.
Right.
I think people are really excited by what we bring and what we know, and that's how we get paid.
It seems like a really great time for this form, this art form, right? For improv,
yeah.
Like it's just,
yeah.
There's festivals and there's all this stuff happening, yeah. And it's something that's inspired so many people, and people
totally.
Feel that they can participate in and
yeah.
those kinds of things, you know?
It's really quite interesting because along the artistic lines, while it's been going up, it's also been going up in the corporate life as well. Like, I live in San Francisco, like Icha said, and there the companies just pay for you to come teach improv to their coworkers and their peers so that you can build team bonding, listening skills.
Sort of,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there's a lot of great applications as far as business uses, and like Facebook and Google are one of the most, they hire us the most to go teach.
What are they trying to gain for people when they're saying we want to, I understand team building and things,
yeah.
but what is it that improv teaches about that?
Yeah, I think that improv, the fundamental tenets of how to improvise well, a lot of that feeds into working together in teams better and just facilitating better interactions. You know, one of the key tenets to improv is really listening, and it's all about better communication and collaborating to create stories spontaneously on the spot. And that's something that, you know, both the corporate world and companies really desire and are looking for to help their employees be able to better work together in projects. And also, improv just happens to be in the kind of like entertainment cultural zeitgeist right now. You hear a lot about
yeah.
it. And more and more people are aware of it as an art form rather than a means to an end of creating sketch or TV shows. People are now starting to become more aware of improv itself as the performance, as
it's,
the thing you
it's
see.
It's permeating so many things, commercials, just on and
right.
on where you see that's people want that spark of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
They get to see that first spark of creativity, which is a thing that great writing is great too, but that is something really interesting. Seems like improv also is, I would imagine, is built on trust, right?
Oh, yeah,
I mean, right,
totally.
That's got to be the thing. And so I could see that in training or corporate environments or team environments being such a key element as well.
Yeah, and it does it in such a fun way. It doesn't feel exhausting to the people learning it. It's like it makes them happier, it makes them healthier, it makes them more alert. So people are way more willing to do that than to, like, sit and listen on a lecture about how to trust your fellow person.
This the coffee shop scenario that you guys do now, is that, how long has that kind of been in development? Is that wildly different than when you guys first started, or is it, or, you know, what was the evolution of that?
Yeah, our show's kind of evolved quite a bit over time. We initially started with a very much open and kind of approach of just taking a suggestion and creating. Our main thing that we've always focused on is creating a single play, a story, complete narrative on the spot rather than a series of random scenes. And from that, we've just kind of really honed in on different things that we want to start from and kind of create structures that let us still have the open possibility of any story can happen, but gives us a few grounding points that that we think is exciting and creates interesting places to begin. So.
And then what's that? Is that sort of the key thing that allows you then to then go forward and kind of you know, explore all kinds of possibilities? You have a one grounding thing about a character, or two or three grounding things about a character, and that allows it to.
Yeah, I would say yes to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Sounded good when I said
it. Yeah, it sounded great. Nodded along. I'm like, yeah, he knows his stuff. He knows it.
Just that one. Yeah. Michael, it must be really fun to work with people who are able to have this be something that they're doing a lot of and are learning from and are kind of seen as really excellent performers here in Juneau.
It is. Yeah. It's great to bring someone in and learn from them because, you know, it's something that you can always learn more about.
Yeah, and, which must be an exciting thing about it, right? There's no perfect, right? You know, there's no perfect improv. Right? That never happens, right? You must have great performances. You must have times when you think like, wow, that was amazing. But it's never perfect, right? Because that's the nature of what it is.
It's never perfect, but it's always unique.
Yeah,
you never see the same show twice. I mean, for someone who has as short of attention span as I do, one of the great selling points about improv is that it's always new, and you're always doing something that's never been done before.
Very cool. Well, we've got two performances this weekend. They're both happening at the Hangar Ballroom, both at 8 p.m. tomorrow night and Sunday night. Is that right? Or tonight and tomorrow
tonight,
night.
Tonight
Sorry,
and Saturday
Friday night.
Night
and Saturday night. Is when it's happening, 8 p.m., Hangar Ballroom. How can people get tickets and that kind of thing?
Come to the door at 7:30 and we'll sell them one.
Wow. Just so that sounds crazy. That's not going to work.
We're going to try it.
Okay. Let's see how that goes. All right. So thanks so much. It's Sarah Shoemaker. It's Michael Ichow and Michael Christensen. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Welcome
so much
to Juneau, you guys. Thanks so much for coming. We actually got kind of a partly cloudy day for you, so it wasn't bad. We've been socked in lately, so it's been rough. Thanks so much. And that's happening tonight, the Hangar Ballroom Improv, happening at the Hangar Ballroom. There's Cogs and Goggles. And then tell me again the name of your...
Tall Grande Venti.
TGV.
Tall Grande Venti.
Gotcha. Yeah. Sizes. I don't... Yeah. I always just say 20 ounce, so I don't know. All right. Thanks so much, you guys. Appreciate you coming in.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Beastie Boys. Well, the rest of today is supposed to be mostly cloudy, but it's just patchy fog happening tonight. Mostly cloudy skies are in the forecast for tomorrow, and patchy fog in the morning. Highs around 38 on Saturday, and the lows around 30 degrees Saturday night, with partly cloudy skies and even sunny skies heading into the beginning of next week are in the forecast. Partly cloudy sunny Sunday and sunny on Monday and Tuesday. So that looks pretty good. Getting cloudy again towards the middle of next week. That's the forecast. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today's Juneau Afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks to all my guests today. Laurent Dick is a photojournalist and guide of polar bears. He's speaking tonight at 6:30 and 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, so check that out if you're interested in that. Rachel Wintz was here, and Cecilia Westman were here to talk about the AWARE's Girls on the Run and Boys Run. Also, check out the Seafood Festival. It's happening. KTO.org is where you can get tickets for that. Troy Quinn and Trevor Fiskus, thanks so much from the Juno Symphony and also the winner of the Youth Solo Competition. Those performances are happening 8 p.m. tomorrow and also on Sunday. And then the Improv at the Hangar Ballroom happening 8 p.m. tonight and 8 p.m. tomorrow. That's it for Juno Afternoon today. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lebanon Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM.